Hi and welcome to the CDC Insight podcast. CDC is the UK's development finance institution and impact investor. And in this podcast series, we share some highlights from a recent Insight event. And in today's episode, we're looking at the role of climate finance in supporting sustainable development. We discuss what exactly climate finance is, how we can scale it up, and we look ahead to the COP26 conference taking place later this year. And talking through this all is our main guest today, Hans-Peter Lankers, currently a visiting professor in practice at the Grantham Institute at the London School of Economics. And Hans-Peter is joined on the panel by Dr. Amal Lee Amin, CDC's Climate Change Director, and the conversation is chaired by your host, Colin Buckley, our General Counsel and Head of External Relations. So without further ado, I'll hand you over to Colin.
Over the past 6 months of these Insight events, we have found ourselves speaking a great deal about climate change, how it's altering the development landscape, its effects on budgeting and ODA, its interrelationship with COVID. Today, though, we address the heart of climate change as it affects development finance, the relationship between climate finance and sustainable development. To help us navigate these difficult waters, we are joined by Hans-Peter Lankers. Hans-Peter is visiting professor in practice at LSE's Grantham Institute on Climate Change and the Environment. And before joining the Grantham Institute, Hans-Peter was vice president for economics and private sector development at the IFC. And before that, he held various posts in strategy, policy, and economics at the EBRD and IMF. Welcome, Hans-Peter. Let's dive right in with this notion of climate finance. So I think a lot of us, when we think about climate finance, we're thinking about investing in large-scale renewable projects, you know, these football field-sized solar panel facilities in North Africa, for example. But what is climate finance beyond just these big programs?
First, thanks very much, Colin, for having me. It's a real pleasure. Now, let me start with the obvious one here. First, utility scale energy and renewables are, of course, a big part of the story. But climate finance is about all the investments that we need for net zero carbon emissions, for adaptation and resilience, and for biodiversity. And this cuts across many sectors. So bottom line is that climate finance for me has five dimensions. It's about enabling sectors through policy, regulation, et cetera. It's about enabling sponsors through hands-on capacity building for bankability, also through risk equity. It's about enabling third-party financing of projects and portfolios, banks and institutional investors through syndication or schemes such as the managed co-lending portfolio platform of the IFC, also blending for risk mitigation. It's fourth about enabling the capital markets, helping to shift demand through tools, metrics, risks, standards, technical support for regulators. And it's fifth about enabling the DFIs through capital, but also perhaps through greater intermediation potential, originate and distribute models and the like.
So thanks. I mean, especially here in the UK, as we're heading into sort of COP26, I mean, there's this growing loud consensus about climate action. But sometimes we hear almost a quiet grumbling about whether there may be, you know, other aspects of development that we are leaving behind. And often this comes under this title, climate justice. So, and I'm wondering, what are your views? Is there a trade-off between the addressing the climate challenge and development?
Yeah, that's a very good, a very important question. And one that you get, you're faced with every time you travel to poorer countries. And there are sort of two ways that I see in which climate and development objectives might clash. One is that there is competition for funds and for attention. And climate might divert the focus away from development impact priorities of many countries, such as jobs, incomes, or education, et cetera. The second is that climate policies and investments might be expensive. And so poor countries are forced to pay a premium for a climate-friendly development path. Now, I think on both fronts, possible conflicts have been mitigated over the past 2 to 3 decades. It was more of a, a clash, more of a trade-off, you know, in the 90s when we first began to talk about these things. Today it's better. And technology has a lot to do with this shift. In fact, climate has become a growth and development opportunity, no longer a cost. And its sustainability is turning into the growth and the jobs story of the 21st century. Now, both at Grantham and at the IFC, we've estimated that the jobs impact of a sustainable investment and growth path is much higher than for the traditional approach. And then there are the benefits from reduced pollution. You have today about 1 million premature deaths from indoor fossil-based cooking and heating. You have about 2 million premature deaths from outside air pollution, like from coal. And then I haven't even touched on adaptation and resilience investments, which are almost by definition, they combine climate and development goals.
We've been focusing on a lot of the new opportunities, but the scale of the challenge presented by climate change for mainstream financing is considerable. I mean, if you think of institutional investors that may be asked to decarbonize their present portfolio and also to develop plans for climate risk, you know, to assess, mitigate, you know, adapt and make more resilient their present portfolio. I mean, that's a massive task. And at first blush, it seems that, you know, there's little commercial value for that work to institutional investors. So, I mean, how do you communicate the need for taking these steps to kind of mainstream financial institutions?
You know, first, I'm not sure little commercial value really describes it for the financial sector. The risks are real. The climate risks are real. The opportunities are real. We understand much more about them today than we did just a few years ago. There has been a lot of work on getting the evidence, getting the forecasts, building them into models that are usable by financial institutions, and they can recognize these risks now. And they're linked to climate change itself. They're linked to policy change. They're linked to technology. You don't want to get stuck with stranded assets. And then you see commercial lenders like, say, HSBC or JP Morgan. You see institutional investors, you see asset managers that have been developing climate investment strategies without being forced to do so. At this point, this is not something which, you know, for the most part, is regulated, which they have to do. And this is in part driven by the understanding of the risks, by where so the world is heading, but also by shifting preferences of investors. For instance, there's been a generational shift in wealth holdings, which is increasingly shifting preferences of the investors. Millennial sort of heirs of wealth are much more likely to want to see a double or triple bottom line from the investments of their monies, and they're making themselves heard. And that's what's bringing very large parts of the assets management industry, of the wealth management industry in this direction. There's also regulation that's moving in this area. So you have the EU Pensions Directive or Solvency II or others. You can see the ECB, the Banque de France, the Dutch Central Bank, they're all talking about establishing clearer regulation in these areas. I mentioned the IFRS Foundation taking the first steps towards accounting standards. And then third, we can help them. We can structure risk mitigation approaches, for instance. CDC is very familiar with that, as are other DFIs, like traditional syndication umbrellas or platforms like the MCPP that I mentioned, which allow institutional investors to buy exposure with structured risks, or market approaches such as ILX, which is coming on stream later this year, which would bundle IFI exposures for purchase by pension funds, or blended finance structures, which can be very flexible, that could lower, for instance, currency risks.
So this is great. Now we're really getting into some of the more innovative financing structures. So perhaps the time has come to have us add one more participant into our conversation. We're now joined by Dr. Amalie Amin, Director of Climate Strategy here at CDC and Senior Advisor to the COP26 unit at the UK Cabinet Office. Before joining CDC, Amma Lee held a variety of positions related to climate change, development, sustainable energy, and green finance within the UK government, at the Inter-American Development Bank, and at the think tank E3G. So welcome, Amma Lee. Let me start out with kind of COP26, because I mean that's being loudly trumpeted as a key moment in meeting the climate challenge. I mean, what are your ambitions and hopes for the negotiations later this year?
Thank you, and it's great to be here with Hans-Peter and yourself, Colin. COP26, as we know, I mean, climate finance is always one of the most important issues for the COP. I think it will be increasingly, or has become increasingly important. As many may be aware, the commitment to mobilize 100 billion by 2020 probably will have not been met last year because of the situation with COVID. And so it's going to be really important to rebuild momentum around that 100 billion and ensure that that comes forward and trust is maintained around that. But I think increasingly we need to not focus only on the quantity of climate finance, but also importantly, the quality and the inclusivity of climate finance. And I think very much as Hans-Peter said, I think when we think about quality, what are we doing with the climate finance? You know, how are we using it to really innovate, to really bring forward the new technologies to our markets, and to do that in a way that will ensure that it's delivering really inclusive benefits. So whether that's gender finance, whether that's reaching, you know, the poorest countries, getting to communities, particularly when we think about the need for adaptation and resilience. So I very much hope that in the build up to COP and at COP itself, there'll be a renewed emphasis, renewed focus on how to really deliver on adaptation, adaptation finance. And that's really one of the priorities that we've set through our climate strategy at CDC.
Thanks, Amma Lee. Hans-Peter, same question to you. What's on your wish list for COP26?
It was good to hear Amma Lee on this and the importance of adaptation, and that's very much what you would get when you talk to the countries that we, that CDC, that the Development Finance Institution is engaged in, and it's often underestimated in the talks. It's underestimated in the North, where we focus on mitigation. The picture looks different when you are in the developing countries. So that's a very important point. Of course, for the COP, I would want to see what the presidency wants to see is net zero emissions targets covering, the whole world. We have about 2/3 of global emissions covered by that today. There have to be targets for emissions cuts by 2030 and a pathway. That's very important. But also that we hear about the how. And when you look at some of the analyses that are coming out now from analyses of the commitments that are being made in large international fora, and then they compare that against what's happening on the ground, there's a huge gap. So to move from target, I just saw, I don't know if you saw this, the IEA just came out with their 1.5 centigrade a path, and it's pretty brutal and stark for the fossil industry. I don't know whether that's so clear to everyone, and it just means that today we have to stop exploring. We have to have a much faster path towards closing coal. We had in Germany, for instance, there was a path towards closing coal by 2038, and now we get it's clear that that's not compatible with a path to net zero by 2050, and the Constitutional Court actually picked that up, which is first time I see sort of climate justice really being translated into the justice system, generational justice. So that will have to be put forward. All of these are issues around the how, and that for me is crucial for COP26. Then of course we have the financial sector, the COP26. Private finance strategy, which puts the focus on the three R's, on reporting, risk management, and returns. And I've mentioned this before. I would like to see all of this becoming mandatory and that there's agreement on doing that.
So Emily, we've heard a lot. There's a lot of talk, and there are a lot of people who are getting on the climate change bandwagon. I mean, just one example would be recently, I think a group of asset managers that have about 37 trillion of assets under management have, you know, pledged commitment to the net zero target by 2050. But I mean, how can we tease out action from rhetoric, and how can we make sure that these businesses are not engaged in what's started to be called, you know, greenwashing, of just using this as a marketing brochure?
Yeah, no, that's a very topical topic. There's been a lot of concern coming from various sources, including Greta Thunberg, actually, on concerns that these long-term 2050 targets are, you know, just pushing the issue into the long grass, not really, you know, a way of avoiding taking immediate action. However, I think what we're seeing under the Race to Zero, so as part of the COP26 agenda, there's this campaign, the Race to Zero. And actually, I think that group of asset managers with support of UNEP-FI have come together with other investors. I think it's now called the Glasgow Finance Alliance for the Net Zero, to address exactly that issue, to avoid the potential for greenwashing. And so they're going to be working together around some common standards to really provide transparency, to ensure comparability and credibility, very importantly. And actually, that's very much what we're doing. Hans Petter mentioned that it's not just about a long-term goal, but it's about the pathway, and it's also about those milestones and shorter-term plans. And that's very much what we're doing under our climate strategy at CDC.
Hans Petter, I mean, again, a different side of this, you know, 37 trillion announcement. I mean, we really are taken back by the size of these numbers that private investment has. I mean, in retrospect, was the Paris $100 billion target ambitious enough, or was it too modest?
The $100 billion are tremendously important in the COP discussions. They have been for many years now, and it's been a really sore point. We're in this together, the whole world is in this together. We need to have the developing countries fully on board in this on this path, and they don't feel sufficiently taken care of. And this has been the problem all along. And I mentioned it with adaptation, which is much more important for many countries than mitigation, and the $100 billion block to that. So the $100 billion has in part just an important symbolic value. This is why we have to get there. It's also valuable, and Amalie referred to the quality of finance, because to the extent that we're talking about grants, that we're talking about valuable ODA, because then you can do those things that we discussed earlier. You can supplement public finance to leverage private by lowering risks, and you can address what you know you might call some of the upstream, the handholding, helping countries actually structuring their projects, etc. So that's why it's valuable. At the same time, it's, you know, the scale of the problem is in a totally different ballpark. So the $100 billion, they're important, but they shouldn't distract from, they're just one slice of the problem. In reality, we should be looking at all the dimensions of climate finance that I referred to earlier. We need to look at creating private investment, and we need to look at mobilizing private finance in very large amounts.
So, Emily, I mean, we're talking about raising prodigious amounts of money. And I remember, you know, that someone once characterized the race to the moon as essentially a financial race between the United States and the then Soviet Union. And it's always numbers that grab the headlines. But, I mean, is the challenge of climate really a money problem?
So, you know, the $100 billion is very totemic. As Hans Petter said, it's really about maintaining trust within the negotiating process. So it is very important. It is totemic, and absolutely we need to see that stepped up and commitments to deliver on that. But I think, yeah, as I said earlier, the quality and the inclusivity dimension is also essential. And, you know, I think Hans Petter said it very, very well. You know, we know, actually, when we look around, there's actually more capital seeking low or zero carbon assets, and going to be increasingly so with these trillions of assets under management looking for net zero, then there are actually those assets or projects, particularly in the LDCs, particularly in some sectors. And so having a resource and putting that to ensure that the pipelines of projects are built, that the policy and the regulatory framework is really enhanced, particularly in the LDCs, to help incentivize those opportunities and really support project developers who can then build out those pipelines that can attract that capital. I think this has to be addressed urgently, really, because otherwise I think we're at risk of not meeting our climate finance commitments and actually helping not delivering on the development objectives as well as needed for the SDGs, recognizing that most of these, particularly on infrastructure, sustainable infrastructure is essential to those growth opportunities that Hans-Peter referred to. So, at the moment, I feel that if we don't start to, collectively as the international community get better at helping to generate better project pipelines that can attract the private capital, we're really not going to deliver on the climate agenda. We're not going to deliver on the SDGs. And unfortunately, we'll potentially end up with, all these asset managers looking to, they'll become increasingly more risk averse to investing in emerging markets, and that's obviously what we want to avoid.
Okay, Hans-Peter. I mean, last question before we go to questions and answers. I mean, Amélie just kind of identified that maybe money isn't the only problem. But I'm going to give you a thought problem, which is all about money. If you had $1 billion, Hans-Peter, I mean, where would you invest it in order to tackle the climate crisis?
I think that's a trick question, Colin. Of course, first I'll make sure I get on the Forbes list and then I put this issue on my wall. No, this is, $1 billion is no money at all for the rich and the middle-income countries. So I would focus it on the low-income countries. I would combine climate with the development goals. I would put it into replicating, I would put it into adapting, scaling technology-based solutions that work elsewhere. For instance, in India, you have a lot of very interesting technology-based solution to climate and development, which we can bring to sub-Saharan Africa. Precision irrigation, drought-resistant crops, mini-grids, supply chain digitalization, and the like. And I would use a slice for technical assistance grants, a slice for high-risk money to blend with commercial investors in order to make that happen. So I would use this billion catalytically to scale existing technologies.
Well, that's a very considered answer to a trick question, Hans-Peter. So thanks for that.
So thank you for listening to this Insight podcast from CDC. If you like what you heard in this selection of highlights, you can find the full recording in the notes section for this episode. There's also a link there to sign up to our Insight newsletter too, if you're interested. That's pretty much it then for today. Thanks again for listening, and we'll be back with another podcast episode in a couple of weeks. See you then.